Welcome to the Religious Studies Project, hosted by David Robertson and myself, Christopher Cotter. This podcast is produced in association with the British Association for the Study of Religions, and you can visit our website at www.religiousstudiesproject.com.
Discussions of religion in the media nowadays frequently revolve around issues of violence and social unrest. Religions and media can be collaborators in promoting peace and opening negotiation. But equally, the media can become host to extremist narratives which may incite violence. Does the media have a responsibility to promote peace? Are religions becoming more skilled at manipulating the media? To discuss these timely issues, we're joined today by Julian Mitchell, Professor of Communication, Arts and Religion at the University of Edinburgh, and Director of the Centre for Theology and Public Issues. He has published widely on religion in the media, and his latest book is Promoting Peace, Inciting Violence, The Role of Religion and Media, which will be published by Routledge this August. So as I said, it's a timely issue indeed, particularly given the recent events in the Arab world. But to start, let's ask, what's the role of the media in religion today? How has it changed?
Two important questions there. First one, what's the role of religion in media? For me, it's very wide-ranging, and it's historical and contemporary. Historical in that it takes place really from the beginnings of religion. You can see it on cave walls, you can see it on pavements, you can see it in artifacts, you can see it in objects. Then you might be able to see it in how religious buildings are built, or stained glass windows. So the shapes of buildings, as well as the objects within them. These are all different kinds of media for me. So they actually are communicating both belief, practice, even doubts about different aspects of religion. So you can see it there, and then you can see it at important communicative transformation moments, such as the printing revolution in the 15th, 16th century. There, religion played a significant role in how printing was used. There's a famous story of, for example, Martin Luther walking around his town saying, "Do you see those two houses over there?" To his friend, and he said, "Yes, I built them." And his friend said, "What do you mean you built them? You're not a builder." He said, "Ah, they're my publisher's houses. So my printers, they made so much money on printing his sermons and his tracts." And so printing was used by both the Reformation and the Protestant Reformation and the Catholic Reformation for promoting their views, in the same way that it was used many hundreds of years before in China, in the earlier printing press by Buddhists. One of the earliest examples of printing is actually of a Buddha, not from a few hundred years later. So you can see it historically, and then of course with the advent of the telegraph, the telephone, the radio, the television and cinema, there is a very interesting relationship there between religion and these different media. There isn't one single media, but there are multiple medias or medium. And they're used in different ways. And of course, what's intriguing is to reflect on how these different religious traditions sometimes are very suspicious of new media. They were suspicious of the radio. They were suspicious of cinema. You can see that not just in Christianity, but also in different aspects of Islam or in other religious traditions, where some religious leaders said you shouldn't go near the cinema. And yet also some other people within different religious traditions would welcome the movie cameras and the cinema screens actually into their places of worship, because they were the largest places in the town, and therefore you could actually see the film. There were many people who could see it. It was, of course, in the 19th century.
Are there identifiable patterns amongst the different traditions? I mean, obviously, what made me think of that is the fact that Islam doesn't like, personification or portrayals of images. So perhaps they would take to printing more warmly than to cinema, say. Certainly the lack of an ability to spread, to make a film of the life of Muhammad, although they did it, but it's how successful it is, I don't know, may have been a challenge in spreading the message in illiterate communities.
Yes, I think different religious traditions and different subgroups within traditions are drawn towards different media. For example, it's striking how often in the Christian tradition, how actually Protestant evangelical groups are drawn first towards making use of media. If you look at the history of radio, for example, whilst mainline Protestants, Lutherans, and so on in the States did use media and radio, actually it was the evangelicals who embraced it because they had a very clear theology of wanting to spread the word out. So, of course, radio is good for spreading words out. Now, you can see that in a number of different uses of different media as well. So, yes, I think it's interesting how different beliefs are drawn to different forms of communication.
And what about the emergence of so-called new media, which will be, you know, something within the life memory of most of our listeners? Were all of the major religious traditions as quick to get on the internet, for instance? Or and what different strategies did they use?
In many ways, it's such a new phenomenon that it's still being traced by scholars. But one of the early distinctions that was made was between religion online, in other words, the leaders making pronouncements and broadcasting or communicating their beliefs and encouraging the faithful to follow in the way or different ways, or online religion, which is where people began to explore and play with their religious beliefs, draw on different traditions and create their own different perceptions and realities. But what's now interesting is how that distinction between online religion and religion online is blurring, because clearly you've got different kinds of playfulness going on between different religious traditions, within traditions and beyond as well.
Great, let's flip the question around then and say, well, what's the role of religion in media today? As I suggested in my introduction, often when we come across religion in well, I'm thinking more the news media maybe in the internet, religion is a factor in violence, in social unrest, in moral arguments. Has that always been the case, or is this a product of the way that we consume media now, or is it a product of the way we view religion now?
There are many important points there, actually, in this series of questions. So it's interesting sort of thinking through which one to which strand to follow, because I think historically there's clearly great variation going on in how religion appears in different media. One of the common perceptions is articulated through news reports, for example, contemporary news reports, is that behind much violence are religious beliefs. It's a common expression that's made. You may feel that's true, but nevertheless it recurs in many different contexts. You'll see that on internet and in newspapers and on television reports. Some people even call this the myth of religious violence, and they trace it not to media but to a historical moment in the 19th century or even the earlier period in the 18th century. So there's a whole philosophy of ideas there, a debate which, I mean, a pretty interesting debate we could have there, but to stay with the media because that's what we're focusing on in the discussion. I think there clearly are occasions where media become the site and source and inspiration for different forms of violence. And sometimes religious motifs are used in such a way as to incite violence. So we could maybe take an example.
Yeah, please, absolutely.
For example, in Iran during the 1980 to 1988 Iran-Iraq War, you have the manufacture and production of many posters and then murals that were painted and put on the sides of buildings all around Tehran and Shiraz and Isfahan, in many different places within Iran. And what's going on there is the celebration of martyrdom. Now, obviously, that's significant within Shia Islam. But it wasn't just contemporary martyrdom. It wasn't just the fact that here are young men and often boys were being killed in the Iran-Iraq War. But it was connected with a foundational event in Shia Islam, which is the Karbala event, which is the martyrdom of Hussein. And it's interesting to see how you might see, for example, a picture of a soldier dead in a battlefield, but behind him is a picture of Hussein. Mm-hmm. So you've got there a connection between two different stories of martyrdom. It's as if Karbala and Hussein's martyrdom is actually happening again now. That mm-hmm. was the visual rhetoric that was used in these posters, and that recurred in documentary films as well. And it was clearly used to try and mobilise a population who were technologically overwhelmed in some ways by Iraq to put their bodies literally on the line against what initially was an Iraqi invasion, and then after about 1984 it became a point where it was perhaps Iran wanted to prolong, some people argue, and prolong the war because it sort of preserved the regime or the government at that time. So there's an fascinating history there around the use of particularly local media mm-hmm. In different forms to promote violence.
Yeah, the historical image is used to create the suggestion of that as a possibility in the present. Yeah, that's fascinating. Mm. So what about the other side of the coin then? How often do we see in the media nowadays religious specialists being involved in mediating peace, in using the media to counteract these kind of uses of media?
That's an interesting question, because one of the difficulties with a lot of peacemaking, peacekeeping, peace building, which is often how it's distinguished, is that these are often slow processes that happen backstage, away mm-hmm. from cameras. And in fact, if you talk to some of the mediators who are also religious leaders, they don't necessarily want the spotlight of media attention on the process of peace building.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, after a 16-year civil war in Mozambique, what you have is about a dozen or so talks in Rome going on that were run by a religious community, but the last thing they wanted was the spotlight of the press on precisely the negotiations that were going on. And you can see that again and again if you talk to negotiators, some of whom are motivated by strong religious beliefs. This was, if I remember rightly, a Catholic community mm-hmm. in Rome that brought about that, or facilitated those peace negotiations. Others, it's moving from different belief points and may not actually be directly motivated by religion. So I think there's something quite complicated, because television news, for example, is often drawn towards spectacle.
Yeah.
And violence is often quite spectacular. You can think of other examples of that.
Yeah.
And therefore it's easier to represent news about violence than it is about the slower process of building peace.
Sure. There's something curious as well, isn't there, that for the news media, they still want to reach out to a religious figure for moral comment, despite the supposed increasing secularity of the state, decline in church attendances, whatever. But it's still religious figures that they want to put up on the screen when it comes to moral issues.
I mean, I do think, as a number of other people have commented on this as well, I think there is a dangerous blurring between celebrity and leadership.
Mm.
And that media likes celebrities because celebrities can build audiences, because we have this perception that we know the celebrity.
Mm-hmm.
And in some ways we know the celebrity, but we don't really know them unless we've met them. And most celebrities we don't meet unless we're perhaps journalists or a member of a smaller elite. But because celebrity suggests knowledge and identification, they can be used again and again because they don't need introduction. You know, Benedict XVI, for example, or the Dalai Lama, these are recognisable faces, and we are hardwired towards recognisable faces. And therefore, these religious leaders can be turned into celebrities and expected to act like celebrities, when in fact, a lot of what they might be doing is backstage private work that may actually work more effectively out of the bright lights of celebrity and media attention.
What about the role of celebrities in promoting religions then? The obvious example springing to mind is Madonna adopting, you know, the Kabbalah Center, and then suddenly a large section of her fan base went out and bought a red thread for their wrist. Is this a new phenomenon, or is this something that you can trace back?
I think there's nothing new under the sun. I'm sure together we could probably think of different examples of that, of famous individuals using their fame to communicate their religious beliefs.
Yeah, an obvious example would be John Lennon.
Lack of beliefs, or individual beliefs. Or
just something as small as putting beliefs. Crowley on the cover of Sgt. Pepper led to a huge increase in sales in books about Crowley.
But I think that one of the distinctive differences from a digital time and an electronic age is the instantaneous nature of their communication, obviously, that now we can see these celebrities, whether they're religious leaders or pop stars or whatever, instantaneously. In our sitting room or on our iPhone, even if we're wandering around on the bus or whatever, and then we can see these characters, and that connectiveness is something which is slightly different from, for example, the building of a martyr shrine, which takes longer. But nevertheless, there are interesting parallels that if you look at someone like Thomas a Becket, several hundred years ago his martyrdom in the 12th century, if I remember correctly. I'll have to check that out. I'm sure this, I'm not going to risk the precise date. Someone can email me.
12th century, that's as specific as we get.
No, it's gone out of my head, I should be. But I mean, for that example, within a few years, news of that had travelled into many parts of Europe, and there were already relics being distributed. So there are parallels there. That it also economically was very useful for Canterbury Cathedral and for the monks there. And there's a parallel, but it was not as instantaneous, for example, as the martyrdom, if you can remember, of poor Nada, the young woman who stepped out of a car in the streets of Tehran and was shot by accident, and then almost, not instantaneously, but within a few days, because of the image of her on YouTube dying, was turned into a martyr and used as a figurehead the response towards the leadership in Iran.
And by anti-war protesters as well.
Exactly, yes. So that's I think that is a significant distinction.
So you're painting a picture of religion having really quite a... or the status and portrayal of religious narratives in the media being really quite complex. In the material I've read on your forthcoming book, you use the phrase "the ambivalence of the sacred." Maybe you could explain what you mean by that.
The ambivalence of the sacred is actually not my phrase. It's from someone called Scott Appleby, who's the director of the Kroc Institute at Notre Dame University, and I'm persuaded by his argument that the sacred can both incite violence and promote peace. Often, the media is represented as a force that moves people towards violence. Part of his argument, and I think which is persuasively put, and I was exploring a very different context, different set of contexts, is the way in which actually religious agents can be part of a process, and often are part of a process, towards building peace. So that might be, for example, we mentioned the examples in Mozambique, but it might be, for example, a community in Northern Ireland set up to try and bring together Catholics and Protestants, something like Coromila or something, which is happening again outside the news frame. And I suppose what's intriguing there is that even that act could be seen as by some people as ambivalent. So in other words, peacemaking efforts or peace-building efforts, perhaps to be more accurate, can be ambivalent, because not that I want to in any way say that they're not necessarily useful practices or process to do, but for some people, if you're trying to bring about peace, but is that happening too quickly when there perhaps has been extreme acts of brutality, that there needs to be some sort of justice first? Now, of course, religious actors are involved in processes of searching for truth and reconciliation, as well as justice, as the foundations for lasting peace as well.
You wanted to talk about the image and the cover of the book. It's from what I could see, it was a tree of some form. Is that right?
Yes, it's a tree called the Tree of Life, and you can actually go and see it now in the British Museum. And what's extraordinary about this tree is not made of wood or leaves, but it's made of armaments, and it's made of weapons that were used during the Mozambique Civil War. And these weapons, at the end of the Civil War, were buried, were hidden. A lot of people thought, well, I'm not going to give them away because they might be useful. And then a local Anglican bishop called Bishop Singulay, was at a peace conference, and he was worried. He was thinking, he couldn't go to sleep because he thought, what are we going to do with all these weapons? Are we not just storing up violence?
Mm-hmm.
And then the phrase came to his mind of turning swords into plowshares. And out of that, working with a number of different NGOs, I think, if I remember rightly, with Christian Aid and with other local organisations as well, he set up an organisation that transforms arms into tools. And the way that process works, you may be heard about it, it's quite well known, is that people would give in their weapons, and in exchange, what they would get would be a bicycle or a plough even.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
One village, for example, gave in, what did they give in? They gave in enough weapons to get a tractor. Children would give bullets, and they would get pencils back. And so you have this exchange going on. So literally, people were being given objects that could try and build a new future for a devastated country where nearly a million people were killed.
Literally swords into plowshares.
Exactly. But then what was interesting was that a number of artists were employed to take these weapons, which were decommissioned, and then turn them into pieces of art.
Mm-hmm.
So there are animals, musical instruments, and there were a number created. And then the curator of the African Gallery in the British Museum was travelling around Mozambique, or maybe I think he saw it in London actually, and thought these are wonderful. Bought one extraordinary piece called The Throne of Weapons for the British Museum, which you can see there.
Yeah, that's the one I've seen.
You might have seen that. But he also then commissioned from four or five local Mozambican artists a Tree of Life, and that's what's on the front of the cover. And it's an extraordinary thing because the sun is actually, it's at sunset, it's coming through the tree, you can actually see it. It's made of weapons from, if I remember correctly, from Germany, from America, and from different parts behind of what was then the Iron Curtain. No weapons were manufactured in Mozambique, they were all brought in into Mozambique. And this picture is actually taken in the Peace Park in Maputo, in Mozambique, of children playing underneath, before it was taken out of Maputo, because it was brought and commissioned, to the British Museum, which is where you can see it at the moment, along with various other sort of animals made out of weapons. So for me, it's a very powerful form of expressive media, which has got a life beyond the museum, because you can see it on the web, in the same way that the Throne of Weapons has a life beyond the museum, because it's travelled around the country. It's been seen by over 100,000 people, and in colleges, in prisons, in shopping centres, and I think they're now planning a trip down to Australia for it, as a way of showing how actually, I suppose, imagining futures for a country devastated by conflict that are more peaceful.
And there's other levels to it as well. The fact that the Tree of Life is a symbol, a religious symbol itself, with significance to several traditions.
Good, yeah.
And then the fact that where I heard about it was online, so it's a piece of media which is being spread through the media in another form.
Exactly, and that's part of what I'm exploring in the book, really, is that how something, an object which might just be seen as a sculptor, has a life in different kinds of media and is used and recycled, and is an interesting critique as well to colonialist Cold War. Because, strangely, these weapons are now coming back to the places that they were manufactured, but they're being taken back there. How are they being taken back? As objects of art. Mm-hmm. So it does, I think, quite cleverly, actually, put a question mark over Western history as well as African history as well.
Yeah.
And I think it's intriguing to see how it does cross over different religious groups as well. So clearly it emerged out of a text out of the Hebrew Bible, was embraced by different Christian groups, but is now being used in different contexts. So that one prisoner, I think from Pentonville, when he saw the throne of weapons, he said, his response was simply to say, the most powerful thing to do in the world is to pick up a book, which is extraordinary sort of juxtaposition, quite surprising. And yet, it's interesting how an object can become a catalyst for new ways of thinking about the world.
Mm. Just to bring this start heading towards a close, do you think that religions in the modern world have become more adept at manipulating the media, more capable of, you know, to use the political term, spin, in order to promote the message they want, be that a message of peace or be that a message of violence?
Again, I wouldn't want to generalise, and I think you'd want to look at specific religious traditions, and I think you could say that some parts of different religious traditions have become more media savvy. It's quite clear that when certain, let's take for example, suicide bombers, sometimes known as martyrdom operations, they are very aware of media preserving what they've done. So they do
filming
media,
themselves,
yeah. or even filming the acts of the suicide attacks. And there's clearly an awareness here of wanting to communicate their message to a wider public. So I think, yes, there is an openness, or not an openness, but an awareness that actually you do, now here's a cliche, but you do want to win hearts and minds.
Yeah, yeah.
But what's intriguing, I think, is to reflect on how some religious leaders are attempting to challenge even that those kind of practices. And I don't just mean practices about celebrating those forms of apparently religiously motivated violence, but also to say that perhaps certain forms of discourse, conversation, take more time than sometimes they're given on particular kinds of media. So that actually a conversation, an argument, may take several minutes to develop, whereas in some news reports, sound bites are now, I mean, there's lots of research on content and sound bites have reduced from 27 seconds to sort of 15 seconds. Yeah. So how do you encapsulate an argument there? You can't, can you? And so I think there are complicated layers of responses. I suppose one of my personal hopes is that religious groups think carefully both as critics of media, but also as critical engagers and critical creators as well.
Yes, in my field, in new religious movements, there were a number of examples where these movements have been very canny in the way that they employed new media. Wicca is one good example, because using the internet allowed Wicca, which had formerly been fairly isolated small covens, to not only form umbrella identities for those covens, which in turn led to it getting more representation on a national level, and ultimately its legal status as a genuine religion, but also led to the phenomenon of sort of solitary Wiccans who weren't a member of any coven but sort of self-initiated, which is basically a whole new form of Wicca, which has allowed it to spread out into the heartland of the US, where there would never have been a coven, but some isolated teenage girl in Idaho can now be a Wiccan. Another example, a completely different example, would be Scientology's fanatical control over their own self-image, and through this policy of, I think it's called, is it called Fair Game, where anybody who criticises Scientology had visited upon them the full legal force that Scientology could muster. They would employ detectives to dig through the people's past to discredit them, and employ the biggest lawyers they could, anything to prevent a negative image, basically to terrify journalists and scholars into not investigating them. Does the media have a responsibility to promote peace?
If you were to talk to a journalist who, for example, was stuck in Kigali during the genocide that took place in Rwanda in 1994, and over 100 days, around 800,000 or perhaps a million people were killed. If you were to ask them there what your role was, you might get different answers, because for someone there who was part of the Hutu power movement, they would actually be saying, yes, we should be involved here in the fight against the dangerous Tutsi. If, however, you were to talk to some other observers there who were saying, well, hang on a sec, someone's coming towards me with a gun or a machete, then my role here is definitely to promote peace. Mm-hmm. If you talk to journalists who have worked as photojournalists or radio journalists or TV reporters in war zones, they are very torn here by their commitment to the locality and wanting to be involved in a process that might bring about peace, or on the other hand, to actually try and act as neutral observers. If you listen to the accounts of someone like Fergal Keane, for example, who's covered both war zones and also in what happened in Rwanda, he says that actually the journalists have got a vital role in bearing witness. This is a refrain amongst journalists and scholars of journalism, that actually there is an important action here that is to bear witness to what's happened. It's not about sweeping violence or suffering under the carpet. It's saying that actually this has happened, and it may be terrible and horrible to watch, but actually we cannot ignore this. It brings distant suffering close. And by bringing distant suffering close, it raises questions around the world. Now, you could say that that is the beginning of a process towards building peace. And so in that sense, they are involved, journalists, whether professional or amateur, are involved in the process of building peace. And I think that's something potentially to be celebrated, partly because we are all here on this fragile blue planet hurtling through space. And one of the things we are still wrestling with is how on earth do we live together peacefully?
I think that's a perfect line to end on, frankly. So I'll say thank you very much, Professor Mitchell.
Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
You've just been listening to David speaking with Professor Jolyon Mitchell of the University of Edinburgh on the topic of religion, violence and the media. Every week we publish a response essay to these podcasts on the website, and this week's, which is coming on Wednesday, if you're downloading this before Wednesday, from Zoe Alderton of the University of Sydney, is going to be considering Mitchell's research in the context of Australia, where the national culture is largely secular, and she's going to be focusing upon the implications of Mitchell's research on Australian media and its presentation or proliferation of violence. Next week, we've got a real treat for you. I'm speaking with Professor Eileen Barker on the topic of studying new religious movements, or what I provocatively call in the interview, cults. So Professor Barker is a world expert on this. Her name is known in academic and non-academic circles, and we are really looking forward to putting that interview out there. As ever, you can follow us on Twitter and on Facebook, and we've had a lot of interesting discussions going on in those forums of late. They are a sort of back end for the website, so there's a lot more conversation happens there, a lot more sort of semi-official things. We'll post comments, quotations from our reading, photographs, and we're also letting you know when we've got an interview coming up. And you can submit questions on there if you're interested in doing that. If you've got a particular question that you'd like an academic to answer, we can't promise that we'll use it, but we'll certainly incorporate it into our questionnaire for the interview. I'm going to harp on again at you about rating us on iTunes. We get at least 150 downloads a week through iTunes, and we've still only had 6 ratings, so it'd be amazing if anyone who hasn't rated us yet could pop on there, just click the button. I'm not saying give us a brilliant rating, but hopefully you will, and then that'll help us get back up into the iTunes charts again, which will really boost our listenership. So without further ado, I think all there is for me to say is thanks for listening, and hope you download it again next week.